I mean, there's multiple things. One way that things opened up for me, that things changed, is that when I was a kid, there was somebody put in a subdivision near where I lived, and there had been these beautiful fields and cottonwood trees and anthills and meadowlarks, and they were all gone. And that was when I was a kid. And I even recognized as a kid, I was able to articulate this even as a kid, that it made no sense to me that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure that one out. And so that was one part when I was a kid. Another part when I was a kid is that, as I've written about, my father's extremely abusive. And my brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He broke my sister's arm. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And I recognized even as a kid that if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? It didn't make any sense to me. This is a crazy way to be. And so that was another part. You know, another thing fell into place. But I was still, you know, those are two parts. And then another part was when I was in college, thinking about the wage economy. And I worked in college. I worked at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. I really hated my job. And I mean, it was a nice job. And I liked my people I worked with. I liked all that. But one of my bosses sometimes would, if they called in sick, they might still show up at work that day because they loved what they were doing so much. And I didn't. I used to call in sick on a nice day. You know, I'm sick of work. And so it struck me that that's really, that so many people, I used to have this habit of asking people if they like their jobs, and about 90% say no. And what happens when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? It makes no sense. Why would anybody create, doesn't matter who, a way of life where most people don't like what they're doing? It makes no sense to me. And so, like, you've heard the phrase, thank God it's Friday. What an obscene phrase, this notion that, yes, I'm so thankful that another week of my so short life is gone. That's insane. And yet, you know, so many people say that. It is Friday, and thank God it's Friday. And so that was another part that fell into place back then, is that I didn't want to, you know, spend my life asleep and then wake up when I'm 65 and retire. And I actually knew people in college who were looking forward to retirement. And that's unbelievable to me. And that's another part of this, is that this culture is killing the planet and it's not even making people happy. Another way to talk, by the way, going back to the original thing, another way to talk about it is, I think another way to talk about it really is the logic of addiction, that I think people are addicted to this way of life just like people would be addicted to heroin or sugar or cocaine or anything else, that it's 'cause it's not serving us well, and it's sure not serving the poor well. And oh, your question, so how I got here. And then it just took a lot of time through my 20s for me to sort of vomit up the effects of all my schooling and to learn how to think and to learn that I was being told lies all the time in history books, in the newspaper. And that was a hard one. You know, I spent a lot of my 20s getting outraged at newspapers because I kept reading them and they kept not matching my experience. And I'm not so outraged now. I'm mad, but, and I'm outraged too, but I'm not surprised. There's the word. I'm not surprised anymore. It's like I'll look in the newspaper and it's like, oh, here we go again. I mean, this is their job. There's a great line by Henry Adams: the press is set up for no other purpose than to tell lies where the interests are concerned. And when I understood that, then I stopped having my guts getting an uproar about that. And instead, it's like, well, that's their job, and I hate them for it. And it's the same with a lot of other things. You know, it's amazing. We're told that George Washington, for example, you know, could not tell a lie. But I didn't know until I was in my 30s that George Washington was one of the most dishonest men of his time. One of the reasons that the revolution came precisely when it did is because he had all sorts of land claims that were so fraudulent that the British Crown was about to revoke his title to all those lands. And what do you know? The British Crown no longer is in charge because there's a new U.S. government. He was extraordinarily dishonest. And even on something like that, you know, I mean, what it's all, it's, you know, Dick Cheney did not invent the whole, you know, and George Orwell and Dick Cheney and George Bush did not invent the whole 1984 war as peace thing. And you can go way back, you know, freedom of the press and then Alien and Sedition Acts right afterwards. It's just at every level, this one of the smartest lines I ever wrote was in A Language Older Than Words, in order to maintain our living, in order to maintain our way of living, we must tell lies to each other and especially to ourselves. It's not necessary the lies be particularly believable, but merely that they be erected as barriers to truth. And we see that on every level. That's so true. Another way to put all that is R.D. Lang, the psychiatrist, came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family, which are also three rules of dysfunctional culture. And rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. It's true on a personal level, in which within an abusive family, you can talk about anything you want except for the violence you have to pretend isn't happening. And it's true on a cultural level, where we can talk all we want about the New York Giants, about the Mets, about the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. Man, they're having a great year. I can't believe that they're actually going to take the AL East. And on the other hand, we can't talk about, you know, the corporations that are killing the planet. It's like a question I've always been wanting to get asked at one of my talks is I've always wanted for an undercover Fed to say, so are you advocating the violent overthrow of the U.S. government? And because, of course, if I say yes, then that's immediately actionable. But I've always wanted somebody to ask that question so I can say, oh, man, you're way too late on asking that question because it's already been overthrown. You know, the corporations have already taken over. I don't understand why all the patriots who are freaking out, you know, get the United States out of the UN and all that stuff, I don't understand why they don't freak out at NAFTA and FTAA and why they don't go after those in power for treason, for subverting. You know, a lot of people consider me an anarchist, you know, who's against all forms of state, all forms of states, nation states, but if you accept the nation states, then I don't know why they don't go after these people for treason, for subverting the United States sovereignty to the WTO and all that. It's, you know, those sort of uber patriot types. Makes no sense to me. And one more thing about that, which just makes me laugh, is that if I were president of the United States, I couldn't do a better job of destroying the U.S. economy than George Bush has done. He's just, I wouldn't have the guts to have done what he's done to destroy the U.S. economy. It's stunning. Which we've sort of gotten a little bit off topic there, but
well, no, actually, none of this is off topic. I want to follow up on the abusive family a little bit. You talked about the rules where everything is allowed to be discussed, but the violence that people are experiencing, and of course the pain that they're experiencing as a result of this violence. So taking the metaphor to this whole society, we have a whole society of people that most or all must be in terrible pain and are not talking about it. Okay.
Oh, and that's true on every level, from like the
I mean, and not willing to talk about to something is to face it. You have to face something to talk about it, right? You can't ignore it if you're going to talk about it.
Yes, I agree very much. And one of the things that happens is that it will, those stories will come out, and they will come out. If they're not dealt with, they'll come out. They'll be enacted. It's like, you know, if you have a child who is in preschool and is acting out sexually, chances are very good that that child has been sexually abused. And they're telling the story. They don't have the words for it, and they're telling the story in the only way they can. And that is something we see all the time. And another thing that adds to all this is that within any abusive dynamic, and this is true whether it's a family system or
capitalism,
a larger capitalism, you know, whatever. It's true with all these, is that everything is set up to protect the abusers. That everything is set up to protect the abusers from the physical and emotional ramifications of their actions. And so that's that understanding that dynamic really helped me understand how the system works, which doesn't help me understand why. You know, nothing can help me understand why, because it doesn't, I mean, child abuse makes no sense. There are many things I can understand. That doesn't mean I'd participate in them, but there are many things I can understand. I can understand, you know, beating the hell out of somebody because you're mad at them. Once again, I've never been in a fight, and I haven't done that, but I can understand it. I can't understand, child abuse. And really, to get back to the bigger subject, I can't understand destroying the planet. But anyway, yeah, there's a lot of this a lot of people are extremely damaged children walking around in the bodies of adults and acting out left and right because they've never faced the issues. And one example of that on a fairly small scale that didn't involve hurting other people but was true is that before I really worked through a lot of the stuff from my childhood, I used to have several nightmares a night. And I would be terrified, and I would wake up literally 30, 40, 50 times a night, terrified. And by writing my book, A Language Older Than Words, and I didn't write it for this reason, I just wrote it because it was what needed to be written, but by writing that book, one of the effects of writing that book on myself is that I no longer have nightmares. It resolved because the story was told. Because it got told and made sense of, it no longer had to manifest through the nightmares. And that's important on a larger scale, too. Years ago, I was talking to Luis Rodriguez, who's an ex-gang member who got out through the Literature Revolution. And one of the things I asked him is why so many gang kids shoot at mirror images of each other. You know, if they're so angry, why don't they at least shoot at capitalists or something? What are they doing shooting at other of the oppressed? And what he said is a couple reasons. One is because oftentimes cops set them against each other. But there's another reason, too, which is that they want to die. And so they're shooting, like I said, at mirror images themselves because they themselves want to die. And he says one of the reasons they want to die is because they're teenagers, and teenagers are supposed to want to die because you have to die as a child to become an adult. And what nobody is telling them is those deaths can and are supposed to be spiritual and metaphorical and not physical. And because they have no social context for having that spiritual death and rebirth, then they end up manifesting it in all physical reality. And that's yet another thing I think is going on the big scale, is that people recognize people know deep in their bodies that this way of life is really wretched and it needs to end. But because they don't understand that transformation could be or could have been at one point spiritual and metaphorical, instead, they end up manifesting it in the real physical world because that story has to be told. Does that make sense?
Now, you said something about how all the institutions are designed to protect the abuser. And what's interesting is that the story that's told about the institutions is that they exist to protect the abused. Right? I mean, that's what the law, all of that, those institutions purport to be about.
Well, it's a big con job. There's a great, I'm going to totally butcher this. This is not a direct quote, but it has the essence of the story. That soon after the Interstate Commerce Commission was formed, one of the owners of a railroad, and it was formed in part because the railroad corporations were so mistreating the people in this country. And a head of a railroad corporation wrote to his buddy who was on the presidential cabinet, I think it was Department of Commerce, but I'm not sure, saying, you know, how could you do this to us, make this regulatory body? And his buddy on the cabinet wrote back and said, you know, don't worry about it. You're going to run this organization. And if we didn't do it, people would express our outrage. But now that we have this thing that purports to protect them, you know, this is going to siphon off anger. And that's the history of any sort of regulatory agency, is it gets captured. I mean, is there anybody who really thinks the EPA protects people? Is there anybody who really believes the FDA is not captured by the the drug companies. Is there anybody who really thinks that the USDA isn't captured by the big? I mean, let's talk about the whole redefinition of organic they tried to do a few years ago, and let's talk about the way they push. The way they push biofuels to help their buddies at Cargill. You know, it's just. When I first started really being a pretty hardcore activist, maybe 20 years ago now, 19 years ago, fish and wildlife was not entirely captured. And fish and wildlife was not great, but they would sometimes help. And at this point, fish and wildlife is an almost entirely captured agency. And, I mean, let's go further back. There's a great quote by Ansel Adams, you know, basically he says, you know, what does it mean that, you know, how is it that citizens have to sue their own government to try to protect them? You know, I mean, it makes no sense that environmentalists would have to sue Fish and Wildlife. You would think that Fish and Wildlife would be an advocate for Fish and Wildlife, but no, they're entirely captured. You know, CDF, California Department of Forestries, is captured by the timber industry. All those agencies are entirely captured. That's the function, is to provide a veneer of protection as they siphon off realistic outrage. Because after all, you know, I don't have to worry about this drug is safe because the FDA approved it, so it must be safe. As opposed to, and that's part of the problem too, is that we, as a people, you know, I'm not a fascist about the we thing, I do it all the time myself, we as a people surrender our authority to those in power. We give up pretty much everything. We give up our health to the FDA and to pharmaceutical corporations. We surrender our means of dispute resolution to courts that are captured. And if you don't believe the courts are captured, there's a bunch of things. One of them is, I've got two jokes that I used to tell at my talks that are not very funny, two riddles. One of them is, what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is 2 life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. Second part is, what do you get when you cross 2 nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, at least 8,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full pay and benefits. And that's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide. There was this representative back in the 1940s who, out of frustration, he was actually, you know, trying to protect people. And out of frustration one day he said, why don't we just go ahead and pass a law saying that nobody who makes more than $100,000 a year can ever be arrested for anything? Because that's, you know, that's fundamentally how it works. That, you know, we're also afraid of street crime, but the truth is white-collar crime kills more people, and it takes more money than street crime could ever. And, you know, we hear all the time about, you know, the terrorist attack on the United States. You know, 9/11 killed 3,000 people. There's 15,000 people die in the United States every 2 weeks from preventable cancers. And, you know, but that doesn't seem to count. And so, once again, I think it's really helpful to recognize that the government is set up to protect the wealthy. And it's not, its function is not to protect you and me. Its function is to protect the rich. And once again, we can look back, so far as the courts, we can look back, why is it that a corporation, oh, here we go, just go a different direction. And I used to ask students at a fairly conservative school that I taught at, college, do you believe that the government cares more for the rights of human beings or corporations? And they would laugh. It's a stupid question. Everybody knows. And I would say, do you believe that we live in a democracy? And they would laugh. You know, once again, it's a stupid question. Nobody of good integrity really believes that we live in an honest-to-goodness democracy. And I'm not talking about the whole, you know, republic versus democracy thing. I'm talking about basically we have a choice. It's so funny. You know, people would laugh back in the 1980s because, what was it, 99% of the Politburo members in the Soviet Union were members of the Communist Party. Well, what percentage of the members of the Senate and the House of Representatives are members of the Capitalist Party? You know? I'm not the first to say that a two-party, one-party system is much smarter than a one-party, one-party system. And so it's absurd And we can go back to all the solutions that are presented by those in power are really, just to global warming, for example, are put in terms of protecting capital. They're not put in terms of protecting... I mean, I got two words to say about this. Dred Scott, you know, the Dred Scott decision. Or back what I started to say a minute ago about Santa Clara versus, Southern Pacific, I think. The one that...
Corporation as persons one.
Yeah. Which, by the way, the judge in that case actually had stock in the railroad. But it doesn't matter. It was this insane decision that declared corporations to be people. And now we follow along. And so corporations are people, but, you know, corporations are living entities according to the law. But this tree isn't. And this lake isn't. And the oceans aren't. And salmon aren't. And, you know, clearly corporations have more rights than family farmers. They have more rights than... poor people the world over. There's 500,000 children die every year as a direct result of so-called debt repayment from the non-industrialized nations, the industrialized nations. So, you know, we can talk about this on whatever level we want. It all boils down the same.
Okay, now here's the question from what you just said about going around, and obviously you've spoken to all kinds of people, you know, throughout your number of years, and it seems to me that the understanding of what a sham this is quite widespread. I mean, maybe nearly universal, but yet that doesn't seem to translate into action. And I don't know the answer to this question, and I don't understand why it doesn't. Right? You know, I mean, because the idea is, I mean, to me, if I did, I guess the reason I'm a broadcaster is I believe that if you can present people with ideas and information, that they'll say, oh, well, this is reasonable and that's not reasonable, and this is what I want and that's not what I want. But I mean, I think, am I making a very erroneous assumption in that? And you have chosen to communicate as well. So, I mean, how do you feel about that?
Heartsick. And I don't think that most people are reachable. And I don't think that there will be some sort of transformation. I don't think that the problems are fundamentally rational, and so they're not amenable to rational solution. So when I talk to 300 people, to 500 people in an audience, or to 100 people, it doesn't matter. I'm not presuming that most of the people are ever going to do anything. I'm perhaps talking to 3 people, 4 people in the audience. And there are a number of reasons why people don't resist, even though they know. There's fear, there's the belief that there's I get this a lot, that people will say, you know, I would fight back, but you know, I don't see an organized resistance already, and they don't want to do it by themselves and so there needs to be some flashpoints. And another part is because we in this country are bought off, and we're bought off pretty cheaply. Access to ice cream 24/7. Access to cable, access to wireless internet, access to... And if that doesn't buy us off, there's always extreme prison terms. You know, the Green Scare victims who didn't hurt anybody got sentences ranging from like 5 to 18 years or something, not hurting anybody. And once again, we go back to Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, who, by the way, was tried and sentenced to death in absentia in India, and the U.S. won't extradite him. And so there's fear is another reason. And another reason is because we have been conned into identifying ourselves as consumers. So you can vote with your dollars. We're not even citizens who can read the Declaration of Independence, where it says when any government or institution becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. We've allowed ourselves to be redefined as consumers so that all we can do is buy, as opposed to being citizens. And there's an even more fundamental and wrenching disidentification that happened a few thousand years ago, which is that we allowed ourselves to be redefined from human animals who need habitat and community to citizens of a state. And and once again, I think that I wish I knew why more people don't resist. And one of the things that I find, you mentioned the Capital H Holocaust earlier on, and one of the things I find, frankly, very disheartening is that so many of the Jews who knew precisely what was going to happen to them didn't resist, and they walked right into the gas chambers. And I am not in any way blaming them or judging them. What I'm saying is that
it's a metaphor for we're all walking into a gas chamber by not taking the actions that need to be taken. And when you said that you speak to...
There's a great line by Zygmunt Bauman, which is that rational people will go quietly, meekly into a gas chamber if only allow them to believe it's a bathroom. And it's the same thing. We will go quietly, meekly to the end of the world if only you allow us to believe that buying compact fluorescence will save the day. Sorry, you were going to say something?
That's okay. No, I was going to say, you said you're speaking to a room of 100 or 500 people, and you expect only to really reach three people in a significant way. So then I guess my question is, have you tried to make a calculation? If it's 100 people, that's 3%, right? How many percentage, what percent of 100 is necessary to overturn this civilization? If someone is aiming for that goal, to build that critical mass, what would it be?
Well, two things. One is, there's another line I thought of that is, I think this was the last poet said it, don't talk to me of revolution until you're ready to eat your rats to survive. So, and there's a line in a novel that I've got coming out next year that one character says to another that fear is the belief you have something left to lose. And that's one of the reasons I think people don't fight back, because they still have the belief that but once again, when the world's being murdered, what do we have to lose at this point? So the critical mass, I think, if they were dedicated and people really wanted to stop this culture and were willing to do what it was necessary to protect life on Earth, I think that 1,000 people, 2,000 people could do it with the right skills and dedication.
That's an astonishingly small number.
I think that this whole system is incredibly vulnerable, and
what are its greatest vulnerabilities as you see it?
I think that I don't think it's a surprise to anyone to say that the entire culture is based on oil, and it's an incredibly unwise way to build a culture that is dependent upon one source of energy. The Talawa weren't dependent. Yeah, they were dependent. They were people of the salmon, but they weren't dependent entirely upon salmon. There were other sources of energy for them, and this culture has been incredibly foolish to cause itself to become entirely dependent upon one source.
If I were saying, okay, I'm going to plan this, I'm going to plan a campaign. The goal is to bring down this society in order to save life on Earth. What should I be seeking to direct my energies toward?
Well, I think,
or someone listening, what should she or he be seeking to direct?
I think that there's a question first, which we've addressed a little bit earlier, but I think is very important to address again, which is that I think long before we talk about tactics. I think what we have to do is to, like I said, recognize what's at stake, and then to decide in our bones that we want to win, and to say that we are going to win, and to say that we'll do what is necessary to win, and to be absolutely determined that we will win, because everything after that becomes tactical. And so one of the reasons that I hesitate ever to be very specific about either vulnerabilities or about what people should do is that there's two reasons. One of that, which is, I don't know what people love. And there could be somebody listening to this who very much loves Atlantic salmon. And there could be another person listening to this who very much loves women and wants to stop them from being assaulted by men. And so those, it's like I have a friend who used to run the battered women's program for the state of New York, who does wonderful work against domestic violence. And I would never ask her, I would never talk to her about oil, and I would never talk to her about salmon, because that's not her thing. Her thing, and she is relentless and she's wonderful, is violence against women. And so my point is, I don't know what people's passions are that way, so I can't tell them what to do. And another thing, I don't know what their gifts are. Different people have different gifts. One of the jokes I've made quite often is that one of the reasons I write books instead of blow up dams is because my only D in college was in quantitative analysis chemistry lab. I mean, you really do not want me handling explosives. And I don't like chemistry. I hated it. And I love writing, and which, you know, I've condemned myself to a life of homework. And so that's my gift. And different people, I know people who get off. There's the question I ask people all the time is, what do you get off on? I don't know what people get off on. I know people who get off on explosives. Every time there's a new recipe, they make it in their kitchen because they love that. And I hate that crap. And not because I have a moral problem with explosives, but simply I don't get off on it. And I get off on trying to figure out what's the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. And so what I would want people to do is a couple things. Is I would want them to find out what their own gifts are and how can they use them in defense of their land base. Two, well, one is determine that they will do what is necessary to protect what they love. Two, that they, well, one, they figure out what they love. Two, they figure out, they determine that they will do whatever it takes to protect that. And three, they figure out what it will take to protect that. Because if you love salmon, your actions are going to be different than if you want to stop men from raping women. And your actions on how you can stop men from raping women are going to be different if you're a man than if you're a woman. And so you see, it gets, I can't tell people specifically what to do. Once again, because that's going to reproduce the same old hierarchical expert talking to. I don't want that. What I want is for people to learn to think and feel for themselves. Because that's one thing this culture cannot stand. Here's what I want to end with, is that there's a, well, what I'll finish that sentence first, which is that this culture can't stand up to a critical mass of people who think and feel for themselves. And what I want to say about that is that there was the head of South African security, nice euphemism, during the apartheid regime, later said that the thing that scared them the most about the ANC was not the sabotage or even the violence, but it was the possibility that they would convince the mass of South Africans not to have blind respect for law and order. Because he said no security force in the world can stand up to a people who doesn't, who don't blindly respect law and order, who don't believe. I mean, everybody here would understand that laws made by the Nazis are not meant to be obeyed. And everybody at this point would understand that Harriet Tubman was doing a good thing by breaking the laws and running and working on the Underground Railroad. But what I want people to do is I want people to think and feel for themselves. Yes, there are some laws that are good if they would be enforced, especially. Laws against rape are a good thing if they would be enforced. But not all laws are demand equal respect. And I think that, once again, Tom and John and George would all agree with me when they wrote that when an institution becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is a right of the people to alter or abolish it.
Derek Jensen, author of many books, including A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, and his most recent, the two-volume Endgame. His website is derekjensen.org, spelled DerrickJensen. And it's also linked on the front page of the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
I'm just driving down this highway, past a shopping mall. I see billboard after billboard, hear the advertisers call. I see cars and I hear cars and I smell cars all just like mine. I see a world covered with asphalt, you're in parking lot G9. Just sprawling on forever, doesn't even have a name. It's a land where everything looks the same. The signs rise high above us, flashing day and night. Verizon Wireless, Holiday Inn, Coca-Cola Light. There once was grass here, maybe forest, but none of that's here now. It's just product after product, as much as time and space allow. My in Tennessee or Texas, Baltimore or Burlingame, I'm where everything looks the same. Ancient forests, family farmers, or the commons, heart of town. Does it make money? That's the question. If it don't, we'll knock it down. There's not a bicycle for miles, not a soul in sight that can't be seen behind a wheel, a few feet from the headlights. I don't know my neighbors, and I feel ashamed. Here where everything looks the same. If you don't like the Walmart, take these drugs, you'll feel okay. Now go sit behind the register and pass your life away. Eat these burgers from the factory, and if you should get fat, just give us some more money, and we've got some drugs for that. In this nation of individuals, is there one that we can blame? Why everything looks the same.
We'll conclude the program with the next installment of our serial reading of the book Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. Last week, we began a new section of the book that addresses the question, why do we put up with it? Last week's chapter concentrated on the use of propaganda to maintain the social order. This week, we begin Chapter 10, Blame the Victim. Cut power or lose it, scream the headlines. In August 2003, an unprecedented power blackout pulled the plug on 50 million people living in a 9,300-square-mile triangle bounded by New York City in the east, Detroit in the west, and Ottawa in the north. Officials warned of further blackouts if people didn't start conserving energy. After the power returned, a radio journalist in Toronto dubbed the Hydro Vigilante roamed the streets interrogating people she found wasting energy, including a man pushing an electric lawnmower and an old woman sitting in front of her air conditioner. Media stories blasted irresponsible juice hogs. I overheard a bus driver and a passenger agree we could not return to our wasteful ways. People felt justified in scrutinizing their neighbors' habits. After all, didn't our wanton use of power cause the problem, and weren't we responsible for fixing it? The answer is no on both counts. Ever since the U.S. power industry was deregulated in the 1980s, energy experts had warned of the probability of large-scale blackouts. Before deregulation, government controlled the generation and distribution of electricity. After deregulation, no one was accountable for making sure the system worked. Freed from enforceable operating standards and hungry for profit, Power companies cut every corner they could. Between 1994 and 1996, there were three major blackouts affecting Western North America. A joint U.S.-Canada investigation into the 2003 blackout found no evidence of excess power use by consumers. The power went out because of managerial incompetence, poorly trained workers, lack of coordination, and numerous violations of operating standards. In short, an electricity grid designed to produce power was being operated to produce profit. Electricity users got no apology for being falsely accused. Ordinary people continue to be blamed and to blame themselves for systemic problems over which they have no control. The reason why goes back to the beginning of capitalism. The myth of scarcity. When France's Queen Marie Antoinette was informed that her people were starving, she replied that if they lacked bread, they should eat cake instead. Her arrogance enraged the people, and they chopped off her head. The lesson was not lost. Rulers who wish to keep their heads cannot openly thumb their noses at those they exploit. Minister Thomas Robert Malthus, 1766 to 1834, was determined to prevent a revolution in England by providing explanations for social problems that protected the capitalist class and its system. To explain poverty and deprivation, he argued that there are too many people and not enough to go around. To explain why wealth could not be shared, he insisted that the poor were biologically inferior and that improving their condition would only cause them to multiply. According to Malthus, natural law, quote-unquote, made it impossible to achieve the ideals of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and brotherhood. Malthus believed that what was good for the capitalist class was good for society, and that any threat to the flow of profits threatened society. In The Legacy of Malthus, Alan Chase writes, quote, "To Malthus, any measures that ease the lot of the greatest number of people, from sanitary reform to medical care to birth control, and above all else higher wages, were not only immoral and unpatriotic, but also against the laws of God and nature." According to Malthus, all such social instruments for the improvement of the individual, family, and public health shared the common and fatal tendency to remove a necessary stimulus to industry, close quote. Malthus is known as the founder of scientific racism because he was the first to use scientific-sounding language to legitimize prejudice and bigotry. His 1978 publication, Essay on the Principle of Population as it Affects the Future Improvement of Society, argues that workers are not impoverished by capitalism, but by their inferior biology. In essence, that their poverty is genetic. Chase observes, quote, "With or without Malthus, people of means would still hate to pay the taxes required to fund effective legislation for social welfare. However, by demeaning the intrinsic worth to society of most newborn children and their families, as well as by denigrating the value to the greater society of any and all human welfare legislation, scientific racism and its propagandists have for two centuries served successions of greedy men and penny-pinching governments," close quote. Malthus laid the basis for modern victim-blaming. He was the first PR man for capitalism, promoting fictions like, "People starve because there are too many of them. They are poor because they are lazy. They are in prison because they make bad choices. They suffer inequality because they are inferior. They destroy the environment because they consume too much. They get sick because they don't take care of themselves. And they are injured because they are accident prone." Before we examine these arguments, let's look at how Malthus' ideas were propagated. The genetic superiority of wealth. Francis Galton, 1822 to 1911, was a wealthy man who perverted genetics to support class inequality. In Hereditary Genius, Galton declares that intelligence is hereditary because the children of the rich are more likely to rise to the top of society. He ignores the fact that they inherit their family's wealth. Because the rich are healthier, Galton argues, they must be biologically superior. Therefore, society could be improved if those of, quote, superior breeding stock have more children and the poor are prevented from having any. Galton opposed all social programs that might allow more, quote, ineffectives to survive and breed. He coined the term eugenics, meaning well-born, to describe his efforts to improve humanity through selective breeding. Herbert Spencer, 1820 to 1903, also corrupted science to justify class inequality. He created social Darwinism, a fraudulent science that applies, quote, natural laws to human society. It was not Darwin, but Spencer, who coined the phrase survival of the fittest. Spencer insisted that the poor are biologically unfit to live and that supporting them only burdens the wealthy with taxes. On this basis, he campaigned against state-funded education and medical care, opposed all laws to improve working conditions, and rejected all forms of charity, including food for the starving. Galton, Spencer, and other followers of Malthus, Malthusians, rejected all scientific evidence that improved social conditions improved people's health. Cholera epidemics had plagued England since 1831. By 1866, a network of clean water and sewage systems ended these epidemics. In Liverpool, basic sanitation measures had dramatically reduced deaths due to smallpox, measles, scarlet fever, and typhoid fever. Nevertheless, Malthusians continued to insist that poverty and inequality are rooted in biology and cannot be altered because they did not want to raise workers' expectations that they had a right to a better life. Like all charlatans, they understood that a well-crafted lie, vigorously defended by influential people, can triumph over the truth. This strategy continues to serve the capitalist class. A 1969 memo from the Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company observed, quote, "Doubt is our product, since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the mind of the general public. It is also a means of establishing a controversy," close quote. A 1998 memo from the American Petroleum Institute outlined its strategy to promote doubt about global warming. Quote, "Victory will be achieved when recognition of uncertainty becomes part of the conventional wisdom," close quote. A strategy of sowing doubt keeps genuine scientists on the defensive, trying to prove the merits of their findings. In fact, these battles have nothing to do with truth or science. They are about protecting the right of the rich and powerful to run society in their own interests. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Eugenics in America. Malthus' theories found a home in 19th century America, where the class struggle was raging. To bolster their side, the capitalist class embraced the theory that the rich are superior beings with a natural right to rule society. In 1910, the Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Harriman families funded Charles Davenport, a professor of biology at Harvard University, to document the hereditary basis of poverty and inequality. At the turn of the century, poor people in the American South were suffering an epidemic of pellagra, a disease that causes skin rashes, muscular weakness, dizziness, and mental deterioration. Davenport was a devout Malthusian who argued that pellagra and other diseases of the working population were hereditary. Appointed head of the Pellagra Commission, Davenport promoted a do-nothing policy on the basis that treating pellagrins would only allow them to survive to breed more pellagrins. In 1916, Dr. Joseph Goldberger, head of the Public Health Service, showed that pellagra was a form of malnutrition that could be cured by eating foods rich in vitamin B6. Davenport rallied influential doctors and politicians to reject Goldberger's findings, with the result that pellagra was ignored for another 17 years. Davenport's mission was to reduce the numbers of poor and rebellious people in society. Allowing them to die from disease was one strategy. Eugenics was another. Davenport's Eugenics Records Office was instrumental in shaping two arms of American eugenics policy, forced sterilization and racist immigration controls. In 1907, the state of Indiana passed the world's first compulsory sterilization law, in the belief that, quote, "heredity plays a most important part in the transmission of crime, idiocy, and imbecility." In 1913, President Theodore Roosevelt declared, quote, "It is obvious that if in the future racial qualities are to be improved. The improving must be wrought mainly by favoring the fecundity of the worthy types. At present, we do just the reverse. There is no check to the fecundity of those who are subnormal." Close quote. In 1927, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of forced sterilization, declaring, quote, "It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from breeding their kind." Close quote. By 1931, 30 states had passed laws to sterilize members of the, quote, "socially inadequate" classes. Compulsory sterilization was promoted for the, quote, "feeble-minded," anyone thought to be insane, criminal, or delinquent, epileptics, alcoholics, and drug addicts, the deaf, blind, and crippled, anyone with tuberculosis, syphilis, leprosy, or any other chronic infection, and dependents upon the state, including inmates of government institutions, paupers, orphans, and the unemployed. People could be designated as feeble-minded and sterilized simply for doing poorly on IQ tests. Recent immigrants, those who knew little English, and the poorly educated fell into this category. In the midst of the Great Depression, the Third International Congress of Eugenics convened in New York City. The Congress called for the mass sterilization of unemployed workers and their children to eliminate, quote, "the existence among us of a definite race of chronic paupers, a race parasitic upon the community, breeding in and through successive generations," close quote. One speaker declared that, quote, "a major portion of this vast army of unemployed are social inadequates, and in many cases mental defectives, who might have been spared the misery they are now facing if they had never been born," close quote. By 1935, an estimated 20,000 people in the U.S. had been forcibly sterilized. In theory and practice, the United States had become the world's foremost advocate of racial purity. Germany's 1993 Nazi Act for averting descendants afflicted with hereditary diseases was openly modeled on Davenport's 1922 model sterilization law. Between 1933 and 1945, Nazi Germany sterilized an estimated 2 million people and exterminated millions more in race hygiene death camps. Instead of being horrified, American eugenicists praised Germany's bold pursuit of racial improvement. In 1934, the editor of the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine proclaimed, quote, "Germany is perhaps the most progressive nation in restricting fecundity among the unfit," close quote. Psychiatrists were especially enthusiastic. In 1931, the president of the American Psychiatric Association advised, quote, "I believe the time has arrived when we should, as an association, again most strongly express our approval of the procedure of sterilization as an effective effort to reduce the number of the defective population," close quote. Between the 1930s and the 1950s, the American Journal of Psychiatry published numerous articles in support of eugenic sterilization and euthanasia. A 1942 article recommended euthanasia for severely mentally disabled children who should, quote, "never have been born, nature's mistakes," close quote. An editorial in the same issue advised psychiatrists to convince parents of such children that euthanasia is the most humane solution. Both American and German eugenics policies were based on the belief that some races are superior to others, and that social problems can be solved by preventing the most disadvantaged people from having children. Historian Howard Zinn points out that the U.S. did not enter World War II to fight Hitler's ideas of white Nordic supremacy. On the contrary, quote, "the United States Armed Forces were segregated by race. When troops were jammed into the Queen Mary in early 1945 to go to combat duty in the European theater, the blacks were stowed down in the depths of the ship near the engine room, as far as possible from the fresh air of the deck, in a bizarre reminder of the slave voyages of old," close quote. After the war, when the full horror of the Nazi genocide came to light, talk of racial purity was discredited in the U.S. Facing a public relations crisis, the American eugenics movement reinvented itself as a campaign against overpopulation. The poor would still be blamed for social problems, not for being genetically defective, but for being morally deficient, lazy, criminal, and most importantly, too numerous. Culling the poor. After World War II, America's campaign to sterilize the poor escalated, bolstered by a new generation of Malthusians like William Vogt. Published in 1948, Vogt's book, The Road to Survival, warns that the greatest threat facing humanity is too many poor people. According to Vogt, the United Nations should not ship food to keep alive 10 million Indians and Chinese this year, so that 50 million may die 5 years hence. Special venom was reserved for advocates of the poor who, quote, through medical care and improved sanitation, are responsible for more millions living more years in increasing misery, close quote. Alan Chase points out how influential these arguments were. Quote, every argument, every concept, every recommendation made in The Road to Survival would become integral to the conventional wisdom of the post-Hiroshima generation of educated Americans, would for decades come to be repeated, restated, and incorporated again and again into streams of books, articles, television commentaries, speeches, propaganda tracts, posters, and even lapel buttons. In the 1950s, the U.S. began testing, quote, population control measures on poor people in Puerto Rico. By the end of the 1960s, more than one-third of women of childbearing age on the island had been sterilized. By 1980, Puerto Rico had the highest rate of female sterilization in the world. Population control methods developed in Puerto Rico were exported for use in other poor nations. The social movements of the 1960s opposed mass sterilization programs, arguing that high rates of poverty were caused by economic exploitation, not overpopulation. In 1968, Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb to counter these arguments. Like Vogt, Ehrlich insisted that overpopulation, not poverty, is the greatest threat facing humanity, and he opposed giving food aid to famine-stricken nations unless they agreed to sterilize their poor. The Population Bomb became a bestseller. By the late 1960s, America was pouring millions of dollars into foreign and domestic sterilization programs. In the United States, poor people, First Nations peoples, and black people were targeted. Poor black women were sterilized so frequently that the procedure was named the Mississippi appendectomy. In 1974, federal judge Gerhard Gesell ruled that, quote, poor people have been improperly coerced into accepting a sterilization operation under the threat that various federally supported welfare benefits would be withdrawn unless they submitted to irreversible sterilization, close quote. According to the judge, quote, over the last few years, an estimated 100,000 to 150,000 low-income persons have been sterilized annually under federal-funded programs, close quote. Despite such condemnation, forced sterilization continued. In the 1990s, Medicaid paid for poor women to have hormone-releasing contraceptive devices planted under their skin. Removing the device was not funded. In 2000, a Louisiana woman convicted of child abuse was given the, quote, choice of medical sterilization or lengthy jail time. We'll continue with the conclusion of Chapter 10 of Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal next week. In the meantime, you can obtain the entire book in various ways through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. Over the coming weeks, we'll be reading the book together, and at the end, I'll be interviewing Dr. Rosenthal and asking my questions and yours. If you have questions and comments about the book you'd like her to respond to during the interview, please email them to me at the email link on the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org, where MP3 downloads of this and all previous episodes are also available. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.